Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Did you know that the most important human invention was gynecology? Not fire, not stone tools, not the wheel, not penicillin, gynecology. What about the fact that humans are not the only species to have abortions? Or that female bodies are probably what led the way to bipedalism? This is just some of what you'll learn when you read Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution by Kat Bohannon. For the last 2,000 years, the story of humanity has been written mostly by men about men. What's more, for over a century, the female body has been drastically left out of biological and medical research. That's slowly starting to change, and what we're learning about the biology of sex differences is rewriting the story of humanity and the story of our bodies, what they really are, how they really work, and where they really come from. Even though we're just starting to scratch the surface of that story, the story itself is 200 million years old. Eve is that story. This book is so fascinating. It's also engaging, easy to follow, and often hilarious. So it's no surprise that it was an instant New York Times bestseller and that it's been longlisted for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction. We also love that Eve is inclusive of trans identities, which is sadly still not the norm for these types of books. So if you've ever wondered why women outlive men or whether or not we evolved to be sexist, you're going to want to check out Eve by Kat Bohannon. Thank you so much for sponsoring this episode.
So hi, my name is Ashley. My pronouns are she, her, and I am joined today with Taylor to talk about Act Two, Cowboy Carter by Beyoncé. My favorite song from the album is Riverdance. Taylor, please introduce yourself and your favorite song from the album.
Hey, y'all. This is Taylor. I use she, her pronouns. And my favorite song, I would have to say probably Levi Jeans or Levi's, whatever it's called. I'm not a big Post Malone fan, but I love that song for some reason.
And what were your other favorite songs on the album?
Of course I love Blackbirds, and Daughter was just like chef's kiss. And then I think those were my favorites. And of course Jolene too.
Yes, I love Alligator Tears, which actually got me thinking, like, have I ever seen an alligator cry? I know it's a saying, but it's an interesting one to me. Yaya and Desert Eagle. And I also loved Smoke Hour with Willie Nelson, spelling K-N-T-Y radio. That just really made me smile.
Yeah, I didn't read into anything about Cowboy Carter before it came out. Like, the only thing I knew about it was like viral song from TikTok. And I was like, wow, it's like Willie Nelson on a Beyoncé album. I love it.
Yes, he's on the album 3 times, I believe. And it's such a nice way to have her usher in this album. Dolly Parton's also on the album, Miley Cyrus, as you mentioned, Post Malone. So it's a few collaborations on the album, but not too many to take away from Beyoncé. As she said, this is not a country album. This is a Beyoncé album. So all y'all who are saying it's not country, da-da-da-da-da, it is a Beyoncé album. So that critique doesn't even fall with this album. So what are your initial thoughts regarding rollout, how the album has been promoted, listening to the album? What were you feeling? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I first listened to the album while at the gym, and I was like, this is not the best place to listen to this for the first time, because you really got to sit and digest. Plus, it's really long, and people like to like stop and talk to me and stuff, and I'm just like, can you not talk to me? I'm listening to Beyoncé. But I don't know what I expected. I think I kind of was one of those people who expected it to be a country album, and it's definitely a Beyoncé album. And I actually liked this one a lot more than Renaissance. Like, this is probably right under Lemonade for me as in terms of like ranking Beyoncé albums. I felt like Renaissance was more so like riding trends, even though Beyonce is like a trendsetter. But I felt like this album really like had her connecting to her roots, and it just felt way more authentic to me.
Yes, something that I must mention is that this year will mark 25 years since the Writings on the Wall album came out. That's the album by Destiny's Child. That is a personally important album to me. And the video that I think about is Bugaboo and the cowboy hats and the low-rise jeans and just the roots that she has being from Houston, Texas. Of course, her parents are from the South as well. So she's shown over decades that she is very much, it's not just like, oh, a cowboy hat is an aesthetic. It is very much in her roots. So understand what you mean when you say like this album feels more of her roots and Renaissance feels, as you said, her into trends, but also just an homage. So it's not so much as she was into the disco poppy kind of era of the album, but it was more so just like her paying homage to a community that has really poured into her. And then Cowboy Carter being the roots that she's continued to lay down or since the decade she's been into this career.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I like the way you frame Renaissance as being like more like homage to like a community, because I don't know, I guess she was uplifting a lot of queer like artists and musicians, but I guess I kind of read it as like, oh, I'm gonna put on rainbow face to appeal to these kinds of fans. But that makes a lot more sense now than my original interpretation. Because, like, I liked a lot of songs on Renaissance, but, like, I had no intention of going to the concerts, or being on tour or going to see the movie. But if Cowboy Carter goes on tour, I might have to go buy some cowboy boots.
Yes, there's going to be a denim on denim moment if Cowboy Carter ends up having a tour. But Renaissance, how you feel about Cowboy Carter is how I feel about Renaissance. Just like the more I appreciate, like that's an album that I find myself going back to. I listened to it. I wasn't like a day of the minute it dropped, I got to listen to it. I was just kind of like, okay, it's available. I'm gonna listen to it. Okay, these are the songs I'm putting on my playlist. And then I remember months later, I came back to it and Move with Grace Jones and Tims was the song. I was like, how did I sleep on this song? And that may be what Cowboy Carter does for me months from now. Like, there may be a song like I was definitely sleeping on when I first listened to it. And I've listened to it a couple of times now. So I think that that's the beauty of an album is that are you going to, is it going to be as soon as it drops, 3 seconds into the song, oh my gosh, this is a masterpiece? Or are you going to be coming back to that album days, months, years later? And I think that both of the albums, Renaissance and Cowboy Carter, will be that album for a lot of people, or it may just be Renaissance is that album, or Cowboy Carter is that album, but that's up to the interpretation of the listener.
Right. And I do think Cowboy Carter is more of a digestion album, because each playthrough I was like finding something new. Like the song, I can't remember what it's called, but the one with Miley Cyrus, like everybody started like hyping that one up. And I was just like, yeah, like the first couple listen throughs. And I was like, okay, wait, okay, now I see the appeal. So.
Yes, it's Roman numerals, Most Wanted, and it's looking like that's going to be the next number one song from that album. And that's what's also nice about getting a full album is like, okay, we can retire Texas Hold'em now. Like, we could put a moratorium on that. If you're still putting that in your Instagram, you ain't listen, you're not listening to the album. Like, it's time to Study up the rotation, giddy up on something else. And you wanted to talk about Jolene.
Yes, I'm big on Threads right now, because I was never Twitter girly, and my Threads feed was all about Cowboy Carter. But something that kept circulating over and over was the article from The Atlantic calling Jolene, Beyonce's version of Jolene, violent, as if there's not precedent of women expressing themselves in more violent ways in country music. Like we have Carrie Underwood before he cheats, and like the Feminist Book Club pick that I didn't know was a Chicks, the Chicks song, since they're no longer the Dixie Chicks. Goodbye Earl. Yeah, I didn't know that was a song, but it feels racially attacking because it's Beyonce and she's almost seen like as an interloper for country music. So I was definitely really annoyed by that perception in that article.
A problem that I've noticed with today, particularly in the media, is that there's an opinion, there's a hot take, and then there's an actual critique. And The Atlantic, unfortunately, what is supposed to be a reputable news provider magazine, is that it was more of a hot take to gain the response from either Beehive or people who love Jolene or people who under feminists. You know, us naughty feminists or whatnot, instead of actually having a critique about the song, it's in no means violent in the way that it was described. But I saw the headline. I didn't even bother to click on it because I just want to avoid giving certain things clicks. But I can only imagine that it's just full of fluff instead of an actual understanding of the song, particularly with Beyoncé's relationship to her husband, Jay-Z. She's had public discourse about their relationship, the ups and the downs, the flaws and all, if you will. You know, Jolene comes from, that song comes from A Certain Place by Dolly Parton. And as you said, it's Beyoncé's version. Dolly Parton gave her a stamp of approval. Everybody else can have an opinion or a hot take, but if you're going to speak on it, then you have to have the history of that song to have an actual critique.
Exactly. And I didn't read the entire article, but from my perception of the article, it was very much like a one, not even a one-sided history, because again, not talking about Carrie Underwood or the Chicks or anything like that, just kind of still distancing Beyonce's work from country music, which we've said enough that this is a Beyonce album. I did think of one more thing that I had been seeing on Threads as well that I wanted to discuss with you and get your opinion on. So, something that's been circulating a lot I've seen is, and I posted about it, billionaires can't be activists. Since Beyonce is a billionaire, she wouldn't fall in the activist category, yet she is a cultural icon, somebody really important to like popular culture, and she makes very intentional statements with her art. I just want to get your opinion on whether or not you think Beyonce is an activist.
I don't subscribe to this idea that celebrities and famous people need to speak out on important issues because I feel that a lot of times it creates a diversion and a distraction instead of a conversation. There's very few famous people and celebrities who can have intellectual conversations, and it's not a part of their brand. It's a part of them as a human being and someone with an actual platform with followers who listen to what they say instead of like, oh, I'm carrying a Birkin bag, you know? And I feel like Beyonce, as a Black woman, as a immensely wealthy Black woman, her approach to being a voice comes differently. There's a responsibility to it, and her responsibility is through her art. I think having famous people be these beacons of respect and how they use their wealth, how they use their wealth is how they use their wealth. But what I'm mostly concerned about is who you carry yourself as a person, and are you bringing to light issues that are important instead of just like, oh, I got an album coming out, so let me put up a ball fist, fight to the power, fight the power, whatever. And I think an example of that is Linda Martell, who is on the album. Linda Martell was the first Black female artist to perform at the Grand Ole Opry. And to have Linda Martell featured on this album, where she's not, where her influence is prevalent, and it's enough to say, like, okay, the listeners can go and listen to Linda Martell's story, her storied career. And so that's a way for Beyoncé to shed a light in a way that's not celebrity-driven activism, but actually a way of honoring the culture that she is entering, even though she has a lineage of, throughout her career and in her family, her Southern roots, the cowboy lifestyle, and it's not just something to do for an album.
I definitely agree, and I think something that's really good about Beyonce and Jay-Z is how they bring a lot of people with them. And I don't know like what they do in their like business, like how they pay their employees and things like that. I do agree with what you said about us placing almost like this moral superiority onto celebrities, like because they're famous, like they have to be morally pure people and taking away their humanity in that sense. Another interesting argument that came up was every time somebody was like, oh, well, Beyonce is not an activist, but Taylor Swift is a billionaire. She's definitely an activist. And it's like, if she's given away so much of her money, like, what is the point of, oh, I'm just throwing money at different social issues versus like I'm actually adding value to the conversation and educating people and like doing work to make actual change instead of like, oh, I'm a philanthropist. I donated thousands of dollars to this one nonprofit.
And I think that that would also mean that the famous person is educated on various issues. And I say famous people and celebrities differently because to me they are two different types of people. Famous people, they're famous because you know who they are. Celebrities, to me, they chase fame. I would say Beyonce and Taylor Swift are in the famous category because even though they dominate tabloids and generate conversation, they are famous people. They're not chasing fame. You have to understand, like, are they educated themselves in these issues? So giving money or giving a spotlight, that's not always as easy said and done, but giving money to a certain issue. And then also educating yourself on the issue, I think, is the way to go. Beyonce and Jay-Z, they have a scholarship foundation. Beyonce has BEYGOOD, a BEY, and then good, where she's given to a number of HBCUs, particularly in Texas. So I also feel like it's nice that not a lot of their work is, again, a part of the brand of like, oh, I got an album coming out. Let me give six Black kids some money for college. You know, they can get something at IKEA. But it's actually commitment to the work and commitment to the next generation so that they can support themselves. And it's like, oh, little Miss Beyonce gave me some money so I can go to college. But it's actually funding and fulfilling the dreams of the next generation. So I actually appreciate that it's not like always displayed, but you know that their work is fulfilling the next generations. And you know, the whole billionaire conversation, you know, I think that that's a whole other education in itself, especially when you're looking at people who are famous.
Right, I definitely agree. And just thinking back to Cowboy Carter and like how intentional, I don't know. I mean, I definitely know that Beyonce was intentional, but I think some people were like, for example, they talked about Sankofa, which is like the Adinkra symbol looking back as we move forward, and they talked about the symbolism and the album cover of like the horse moving forward but Beyonce facing backwards. And somebody commented after somebody posted that and was like, well, did she actually come up with that, or is that your interpretation? And I was just like, who cares? Beyonce did so much intentional like work in history and like nuance with this album. Who cares if we project a lot of like other symbolism and things, because that comes part of like how she is a cultural icon, how this album is iconic. I just think that like layer of intentionality where that sets her apart, kind of like what you were saying of the difference between like celebrities and famous people. And that's how I place Beyonce in a category of artist versus like just celebrity. It's always more to the surface than a lot of what you see. And I really appreciate that about Beyonce in general, and or how she's grown as an artist and this album.
As we close this conversation, I think that that's a great place to begin this end. Finishing the album, I understood that Beyoncé is a student of her craft and also a legacy of her lineage. She's very much rooted in her family and her career. She's released the album. The album is it's no longer hers, but she recorded it as she wanted to. How the public receives it is how it's received. Should she go on tour, that's going to be another way for us to receive the album that she's been planning. Renaissance and Cowboy Carter are the signatures of her declaration of being an independent woman. To throw it back again to Destiny's Child, I will never not have a Destiny's Child pun intended. So, Taylor, any lingering thoughts around Cowboy Carter, the album, Beyoncé's career in general?
I'm just excited for Act Three, and I'm hoping it's kind of like a rockish Tina Turner type album, because Yaya is fire. I forgot about Yaya. So, yes.
Yes, I've already thought about people who I would love to hear on Act Three, and it seems like she's teasing it already. And whenever she decides to bless the world with it, we will be ready to receive it. Thank you, Taylor, for talking with me about Cowboy Carter, Act Two from Beyoncé.
Yes, this was fun.
What would you do? Kira's entire reputation is built upon the development of ethical computing. Her AI, Ellie, is the testbed and best example of using her moral operating system. Her absolute dedication to improving kids' lives could now put all she's worked for at risk. Kira thought she and Ellie, with her ethical framework, could keep everything under control. Against conventional wisdom, it's not the AI's moral decision-making that's the problem, it's the people. This is the setup for Moral Code by Lois and Ross Melbourne, a science fiction novel that explores themes of corporate ethics, exploitation, and the intersection of innovation and morality. When Dr. Kira Stetson merges her company with billionaire Roy Brandt's secretive nanite technology, she finally has access to some much-needed funds. Kira's decision to embed her moral operating system into Brandt's nanite smart dust reflects her commitment to ethical technology development. But it turns out, there's a reason his technology has been such a closely guarded secret. Now she must confront the sinister motives of corporate raiders and the military who seek to weaponize Brandt's nanites, posing a threat to both individuals and society at large. Moral Code asks the reader to consider important and interesting questions, ones that are particularly relevant right now with the rise of AI and the ever-growing greed of capitalist interests. Plus, we want to highlight that 100% of the proceeds generated through the sales of Moral Code will be donated to help fight the child abuse and human trafficking of kids. You can learn more about Moral Code and download a free chapter at moralcodethebook.com. Thank you so much for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, everyone. What's up? It's Natalia. It's a long time no talk to, but I'm excited to be talking to you today. And we're going to touch on data collection and the federal government. And I know you're so excited, but I promise you it's going to be interesting. So let's just really dive in. One of the most popular blog posts on the Feminist Book Club blog is Yassi Agha's 2021 post, where she asks if Middle Eastern people are really white. In the post, Yassi brings up the US Census and how there's no category for her as a Middle Eastern person. And the comments on the post are really interesting because they range from introspective to absolutely fucking hateful. You should see the ones that I delete. They're abominations. Anyway, this post has stuck with me for the past couple of years as I kind of really consider how demographic data is collected. And I ran into my own frustrations with how the government collects demographic data when I was doing research on disasters. In possibly the nerdiest thing that I'm ever gonna say, I was so surprised and excited when I was scanning the news and I found that the government issued an update on Statistical Policy Directive number 15. What is this? You're asking yourself and me. And I am here to tell you. Statistical Policy Directive 15, we'll call her SPD 15 between friends, was created in 1977 to provide consistency on the minimum categories that federal agencies have to use to collect information related to race and ethnicity. What do I mean by minimum categories? Think of it this way. An agency can always ask more granular questions regarding to race and ethnicity, but they are required by this directive to use a minimum of 7 standards set up by the Office of Management and Budget. This impacts everything from the census, big household surveys like the American Consumer Survey, federal forms for benefits like Social Security, VA benefits, forms that you fill out after disasters with FEMA, and a variety of other things. In researching this segment, I found out that the only other update from 1977 was in 1997, and this introduced the ability to select multiple races, which, as someone who takes advantage of that option, thanks, broke apart the Asian category to create an option to select either Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander and Asian, and expanded Hispanic to include Hispanic or Latino. Interesting to note here that the desire to add a category for Middle Eastern and North African people was considered way back in 1997, but was summarily dismissed with very little discussion. I wonder why. That was. The 2024 update is effective as of March 28th, 2024, and it does 3 things. First, it combines questions about race and ethnicity into 1 question instead of 2 or more questions. The new question is, what is your race and/or ethnicity? Select all that apply and enter additional details in the spaces below. Based on the discussion, it seems to be driven largely by the need to accurately collect information on Hispanic and Latino folks in the United States, which makes sense as we're estimated to be a little over 28% of the population in the U.S. by 2060. The second major change, and why I bring up Yossi's post to begin with, is that they added a category for people to select Middle Eastern or North African as a response. In the Federal Register report, the Office of Management and Budget notes that nearly all comments addressing the MENA category supported the proposal. Commenters expressed that the current classification of MENA respondents as white does not reflect the reality of many who are MENA. This is huge. This update gives federal agencies 18 months to implement the changes. But generally, these should be in place before the 2030 census. There were also other changes where they updated language, which gave respondents context on what the minimum categories mean, which is really beyond the scope of this segment, but know that it's valuable and will make for a far more accurate picture being taken by the government of who lives here. So, how is this feminist? Why is it important? Or why do you, as a non-data person, even want to know about this? So I'm going to take you through this at the highest level, which is the Constitution, and then go to local levels. First, the Constitution, right? Big document, hasn't been changed in much, at least in 200 plus years. It requires a decennial census to happen, which is used to apportion seats in the House of Representatives, define legislative districts, school district assignment areas, and other functional areas of government. And that functional areas of government can mean anything from the CDC's usage of demographic data to determine mortality rates in an area by race or ethnicity, FEMA's usage of demographic data to determine aid distribution or grant distribution by race or ethnicity in just a variety of different ways. By creating a minimum standard of categories that need to be collected, the federal government is saying, hey, CDC, you can get more than this, but at a minimum, you need to know if people fall within the 7 categories. And if a trend is seen where more Black pregnant folks are dying, or MENA people are being exposed to a virus, or Hispanic or Latina folks are being arrested, that is important and that is vital to understand from a public health perspective. Because how do you accurately message information if you don't know who you're messaging the information to? How do you deconstruct pervasive and systemic problems if you don't know that they exist? Demographic data gives us a place to start from, and you can extrapolate this across many areas of the federal government, from understanding if the Veterans Affairs Department is consistently denying benefits to certain people, or if the National Highway Administration is funding transportation and infrastructure projects which serve to benefit or exclude a population. Demographic data can direct funding to places where it's most needed and or show us how funding is not reaching impacted communities. As we get down to state governments, it's important to note that many states' governments or state governments model their demographic questions on forms to mirror federal requirements. So there's a one-to-one alignment, because who wants to recreate the wheel? When it comes to states using these federal funds, the demographic information gathered is used to create the definition of who's eligible for this money. There are complex mathematical formulas which have variables that need to be filled in by the demographic data to determine fund allocation, and competitive programs, think like housing vouchers, arts scholarships or arts money, money for science projects, but like the big college ones, etc. Those all, in most instances, require this demographic data to meet certain eligibility requirements. And then there's the issue of congressional districts. Before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, it was there to protect equal access to elections for all eligible Americans and was the primary way that Congress had to enforce the rights guaranteed to folks under the 15th Amendment. And with accurate data regarding race and ethnicity, it became much easier to spot patterns of disenfranchisement in not just federal elections, but state elections as well. Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, those are 3 examples off the top of my head that I can think of where state legislators use census data in part to create voting districts, which are so gerrymandered and absolutely serve to dilute the voting power of certain groups and even knock out elected representatives from office by putting them in districts where they could never hope to win the district. It's definitely a double-edged sword. But generally, by understanding who is here and how they identify, you get an insight into what problems they may be facing. By understanding their problems as an intersection of all the things that make someone human, you can then better understand what services may be necessary at a local level. You can see which gaps exist and try to hold your government or community accountable for addressing them. I do want to note, however, that I kind of went down a rabbit hole while I was researching this, and I want to make it very clear that this is just one aspect of personhood, right? There are other things that make people people, including sex and gender. Now, interestingly, the guidelines on sex and gender are outside of the purview of SPD 15, but also outside of the purview of any statistical policy directive. A June 2022 executive order, Executive Order 14075, if you're curious, provides recommendations or suggestions to federal agencies on best practices for the collection of self-reported sexual orientation and gender identity, or SOGI information, on federal statistics surveys, and make it very clear that the order, quote, does not mandate any particular approach or create any new requirements for agencies, end quote. Which is really kind of bullshit if you think about it. In all my research for this segment, I couldn't find any directive which required a minimum collection category or categories on data for sexual orientation and gender identity. And if anyone out there knows where that can be found, please, please, please let me know. Without minimum federal standards for SOGI data, I'm curious as to how we can hold elected officials accountable for exclusion of funding, benefits, etc. Cynically, I understand that this is likely the point, and you can't claim disenfranchisement where data doesn't exist, so it's likely a thorny issue. But I would be curious about how funding for FEMA, for example, serves or fails to serve communities which exist outside of the binary. I have the privilege of being a cishet woman, even though I face different oppressions regarding my race and ethnicity. None of us is ever one thing, and instead we are and contain multitudes. SOGI information is definitely an area of opportunity, as employment reviews I am working on like to use, and I want to see more than a 2015 working group appointment and more like a move towards their very own statistical policy directive. It's my data, and I want it now. Any hoozles, that's it for me today. I hope you've learned a little something and feel like we've moved at least one step forward, even if we have so many steps to go. Feel free to follow me on Instagram at NatSandPaul and check out the Feminist Book Club blog at feministbookclub.com/blog. It's my baby, and the contributors are amazing, and I love them all. Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club. A well-read woman is a